השם לי יקוי ואל תהי ירו, עבדי יקוי ואל תהי ירו, עבדי יקוי. בוחר השם בי יקוי, אל תהי ירו, עבדי יקוי ואל תהי ירו, עבדי יקוי. וי גורל השם מהס יחקוי, אבל תהיי ירו עבדי יחקוי. וי דורך קוי חוב מי יחקוי, וי אבל תהיי ירו עבדי יחקוי. אבוים ישש יקוי,
אלתינו אבי יקוי,
ויהד מי יקוי,
אלתינו אבי יקוי,
זכור זויס ליקוי,
אלתינו אבי יקוי,
חדבש ישו איס יקוי,
אלתינו אבי יקוי.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming. I just wanted to thank the sponsor for today's shiur, a good friend of mine, Justin Beck. This is to honor his mother, who had passed away just about a month ago, just commemorated the Shloshim, Leah Bas Anshel. May her neshama, may this be a very great tzchus for her soul, and to all the spiritual heights that she reaches as a result of this mitzvah and all the other good deeds that are done in her behalf, may she reciprocate and channel down that light and those blessings to you, Justin, to all of your family, and may you only know simchas from now on. The CD this week would like to dedicate to a very special soul, a beautiful diamond that sadly our community has lost in this past week. Habacher Hatamim Yosef Ben Reb Nachman Ber. May this be a very, very great tzchus for her, his neshama, and may the family be comforted and not know of any pain anymore. And the truth is, the only comfort that is acceptable at this time is the coming back of the restoration of the body back, of the neshama back into the body. Where neshamas belong, because that's what Hashem's desire was, that neshamas should be in this world to illuminate and to bring godly light into the world. And that's where all neshamas belong. So we hope very soon, speedily, we will celebrate the coming of Mashiach, and Yosef will be back with us, and back together with his family, with the resurrection. May that happen so quickly, take of now. This week's parsha is Parshas Vayetze. And the story of the parsha is a story about Yaakov, how Yaakov left the house of his father, and he went far away. He went to Haran, he went to ancient Mesopotamia, and this was all because he was running away from his brother's wrath. He was running away from Esav, who was chasing him, was angry at him because of the blessings that Yaakov had taken from him. So, in a nutshell, the parsha relates how Yaakov left his father's house, went down to Haran, and over there he got married, and not one time, but he got married four times, and established a family, the Jewish family, finally the first Jewish family. 11 out of his 12 sons were born to him in Haran, and after that he amassed a great fortune, and then all the way at the end of the parsha we have Yaakov returning to the land of Israel, to his father's house, with a huge family and a very, very, very wealthy person. So this is the story in short. Now, in the past couple of classes, we emphasized and studied the name of the parsha. And the idea being that a name expresses the essence. Now, unlike the previous parshas that we learned earlier, Parshas Toldos, Parshas Chayesara, where we had a serious problem with the name, it was hard to figure out why this is the name that would characterize the entire parsha. In this parsha, it's quite clear. Vayetze, Yaakov goes out. It's clear the meaning of Yaakov going out, the parasha should be called Vayetze, going out, because Yaakov left. And the entire parasha discusses Yaakov as he is outside of his homeland, away from his parents. He is outside of his environment. And so he's in a state of Vayetze, away, going out. And that's the entire parasha. So the name fits the content of the Torah portion. However, the difficulty is that it doesn't seem to fit the personality of Yaakov, of who Yaakov is as a human, as a person. When we read earlier in the parasha, Parsha has told us last week when Yaakov is born, the description we have of Yaakov is that he's a ishtam, he's a wholesome person. Yoshev aholim, he sits in the tents, which emphasizes that Yaakov is a man that remains inside. He's not a social person. He's not out with people. He is an introvert. All his life he spends in diligent study, away from society. His brother, Esav, he's a man of the outside. Esav is an ishsadeh, a man of the field. As it says, you know, and the man of the field means not just being in the field as a hunter, but that he was a wheeling and dealing. He was a merchant, involved with people out in the outer world. And that's not the story of Yaakov. Yaakov is also the pillar of Torah. Torah study is done in the inside. We know the world stands on three pillars, Al HaTorah, Al HaAvodah, Al Gemilas Chasadim, on Torah and on divine worship, which is prayer, Gemilas Chasadim, kindness and charity. And each one of the three patriarchs embodied or the personification of one of these pillars. And Yaakov is Torah. So Torah is an indoor exercise, an involvement that you do in the inside. And Yaakov was a Torah scholar par excellence. So why is it that the first Torah portion, that the Torah is describing the life of Yaakov, it's a series of six Torah portions that are dedicated to Yaakov, and all six of them, and out of the six, you know, the first one is Parshas Vayetze, and we get our first impression by the first one. And the impression we get about Yaakov is Vayetze. He's going out. And that's counter or opposite of the character or the personality of Yaakov. So that needs some understanding. Now, when we read the actual first pasuk, it says Yaakov went out mi be'er shava, and he went to Haran. Vayelech Harana. Now, and the medrash seems to be perturbed. Why does the pasuk say that he went from be'er shava? What difference does it really make where he's going from? The main thing is that he went to Haran. That's what the Torah is describing. Where he went to. So the actual description of why he went out, why does the Torah tell us that he left? Rashi already explains, and that is because it was felt. Yaakov's leaving was felt in Be'er Shava. They missed him. There was a emptiness that was sensed as he left. So that's why the Torah says Vayetze went out. But why does it have to say from exactly the city from where he left? So the Medrash says that Be'er Shava means, has besides the name of a city, has a meaning. That Yaakov left Haran, it's actually a reason why he left. He left because he did not want to be in Be'er Shava. He wanted to go away from Be'er Shava. What is Be'er Shava? Mi Be'er Shavua, from the spring, from the well of the oath. As we learned earlier, the reason why the city was called Be'er Shava was because Avram and Yitzchak both made a treaty with Avimelech, which involved an oath. The oath that we will not attack you, you will not attack me. We will have a peace treaty amongst us. And that's why they named the city Be'er Shava, from the word Shavua, which is an oath. Now Yaakov did not want to have anything to continue that treaty. He was afraid that Avimelech would seek him out, and he would want to extend that treaty with the third generation, with Yaakov. Yaakov, as the Medrash says, didn't want to have anything to do with that. That's why he left. And where did he go? So he ran away. He ran as far as he can from the reaches, from where Avimelech would be able to reach him. Looks like he would be able to get to him anywhere in the land of Israel. So that's why Yaakov had to leave and go away. What was so bad? What would be so bad if Yaakov made this treaty? So the Medrash says that because Avram made the treaty with Avimelech, that caused a delay in the entry of the Jewish people into the land, that for 7 years the Jewish people were withheld from going into the land of Canaan because, seven generations it took for the Jewish people, because Hashem had promised the land to Avram, but the Jewish people didn't conquer the land until the seventh generation from Avram. Moshe Rabbeinu began the conquest of the land, but he didn't complete it. The reason why Moshe didn't complete it was because Yitzchak, a generation after Avram, continued and reestablished this covenant, or reestablished this bris and this treaty with Avimelech. So he pushed it off another generation. So it now is, because Yeshua was the one who, which is the seventh generation from Yitzchak, the eighth generation of Avram, who completed the conquest of the land. And the reason why it took so long, which Hashem intended to give it to Avram and to Yitzchak, was because they made this treaty with Avimelech. And Yaakov did not want to be a cause of delaying the entry into the land for anymore. So in order to avoid that, Yaakov ran away from Be'er Shava, and he went to Haran. And this needs some explanation. Because if the making of the treaty with Avimelech is so bad and is so wrong, so why is it that Avram and Yitzchak went along with it? Why did they make the treaty? And if we're going to say that Yaakov knew what they didn't know, it's difficult to say that. I mean, why would Yaakov understand or see that this was a negative thing and they didn't know this? And if we're going to say, well, okay, because Yaakov saw the consequences which happened as a result of what they did, well, then Yitzchak also shouldn't have made the treaty after he saw what Avram caused by making this treaty. And besides this, that we don't find anywhere in the Torah that there is the Torah criticizes Avram and Yitzchak for doing this. I mean, besides in this Medrash, we don't find any criticism in the Torah for this treaty that was made with Avimelech. So that seems to imply that it wasn't bad after all, that Avram and Yitzchak did not do the wrong thing, they did the right thing. And even though they knew that this would delay the entry into the land, nevertheless, that was the right thing to do. But then the question is on Yaakov. If Avram and Yitzchak made this treaty, knowing the consequence, knowing that what this is going to cause, nevertheless they went along with it because it was the correct thing to do. So why is Yaakov avoiding it? Why did Yaakov? Why isn't he following in his parents' footsteps? So this leads us to say that what was correct for Avram and Yitzchak, that for them it was the right thing to do, would be wrong for Yaakov. Yaakov is not supposed to make this treaty. That's why, in order to protect himself, so that he had to leave, he had to run away from him, because it was good for them and it wasn't good for him. So we need to understand what is the difference of Avram and Yitzchak, and for them it was the right thing to make this treaty, and for Yaakov it would be the wrong thing. That's question number one. The second thing that we also need to understand is the second half of the pasuk, when it says Vayelech Harana, that Yaakov went to Haran. Is the going to Haran a part of a continuation to this idea that he does not want to make the treaty with Avimelech? Or is it just because he had to go away from Be'er Shava, so he went to Haran? Which means we can look at going to Haran two ways. His main intention over here was he has to get away from Be'er Shava. He wanted to get away from making that covenant. Now, parenthetically, of course, the Medrash isn't saying that this is the only reason why he left the land of Israel, he left Be'er Shava. It's clear from earlier that his mother told him that he should run away because Esav wants to kill him. Also, his father commanded him to go look for a wife. So he had other reasons why he had to leave Haran. Well, one of the reasons why he left, the Medrash is saying, in addition, was because he wanted to go away from Be'er Shava. But now the question is his coming to Haran merely because, since he has to go out of the land, that was the safest place over there, he had a relative, that's where he can go? Or is the going to Haran connected to his avoidance of Avimelech? Which would mean that the way Yaakov is dealing with the problem called Avimelech is that he goes to Haran. And that's seemingly what would make sense, because the pasuk connects the two. The Yetze Yaakov Mebe'er Shava, Vayele Harana. He's leaving Be'er Shava and he went to Haran. Meaning that Yaakov's solution to the problem of Avimelech is to go to Haran. So we need to understand why does Yaakov differ than his parents. Avimelech is obviously an obstacle. Avimelech is an opposition to godliness. You see that the Avos are somewhat in conflict with Avimelech. First he takes their wives, and then he's impeding on their well digging, stuffing up their wells. He is a troublemaker. So we have to deal with Avimelech. How do we deal with Avimelech? Well, the way that Avram and Yitzchak deal with Avimelech is by making a treaty with them. And the way Yaakov deals with Avimelech is by going away, but not by avoiding, because you don't resolve any problems just by avoiding. Yaakov tackles Avimelech and works on this unholiness, on this opposition that is opposing holiness and godliness in the world by going to Haran. That's the solution to Avimelech. So we need to understand why and what manner is going to Haran in any way going to influence and change Avimelech. So to understand all the above, we need to review a little bit the theme in which we've been developing in the last few classes. We began in Parshas Vayera, in which we began to introduce the idea of the presence of the Jewish people in this world. What is the objective? What are we doing here? As explained then, we are not, in essence, we are not creatures. We are not element, part of the element of creation. A Jew is a godly being. A Jew is a piece of Achelik Elokai Memal, a piece of Hashem from above. What then is a Jew doing in this world? It's God extending himself. It's a divine extension into this world. We are Hashem's ambassadors, the emissaries of God into creation in order to bring godly awareness to the creation. There is a creation, and the creation is a creation of concealment, a creation that doesn't know of Hashem, and the Jew is introduced into the world in order to bring Gilui Elokus, in order to bring, to spread, to disseminate God, divine consciousness through humanity and through all of creation. That's why we explained in the first year in Parshas Vayera that the indication of this is that the Jewish people are born miraculously. The first Jew, Yitzchak, is born in a miracle. He couldn't, and even though Avram suggested that Yishmael should be the father of the great nation, he didn't believe that he was worthy for the great miracle of Yitzchak's birth, but Hashem told him Yishmael cannot suffice, he can't do, because Yishmael is a natural human being. And the Jew is not just an enlightened human being, the Jew is a godly being. His soul is not even part of the creation. He's infinite, he transcends nature. Yishmael is forever bound and locked by the constrictions, by the limitations of nature. And that's why he couldn't father the great nation. The Jew is the symbol of the miracle in this world, the symbol of the godly, what transcends, what is above the natural. That was the element that we had emphasized and developed in Parshas Vayera. Now, in Parshas Chayesara, we extended that idea in explaining what Sarah, the contribution that Sarah did to the Jewish people, is that she created the borders and the parameters that would define and keep the Jewish people separate and defined from the rest of the world. Because even though it is our job to influence humanity, and to influence humanity, we must be to some degree integrated. That's why our souls are invested in bodies that are human like all other human beings, and we have human features like all of the rest of humanity, all the rest of the creation. However, and our job is to mingle with the rest of the world, live amongst the nation, especially during the exile and the like, so that we can interact with the world. But on the other hand, we have to keep a separation. We can't assimilate, because if we assimilate, then we will lose our identity and we will not be able to influence. We will compromise our own godliness and our own holiness, and we will defeat the purpose of why our neshama came into this world, to enlighten, to illuminate all of the rest of the world, to sublimate all the rest of the creation. That's why the Jews have to have a very strong identifiable existence in this world by setting up borders and boundaries. Sarah was the one who gave us our Jewish pride. And that was the theme of Parshas Chayesara. Then we continue. In last week's class, Parshas Toldos, where we began to discuss the influence that Avram and Yitzchak had on the rest of humanity. In other words, the implementation of the Jewish mission, of the job of the Jew in this world to have an effect of humanity and bringing the creation closer to God, that effect began in the days of the Avos by Avram and Yitzchak, which means not only are they establishing a people, a nation, that will later influence all of humanity, but they themselves began laying the groundwork, and they themselves began in this operation of reaching out into the darkness, into the world that isn't holy, and sublimating it and make it holy. And we learned that the method in which they used Avram and Yitzhak was both different and incomplete, which means Avram had a big influence, a big impact on the world, but he didn't completely and thoroughly accomplish it. It was only a beginning. Yitzhak also had a great effect on the world, but again, it was incomplete. The completion of the job, as we're going to see, was Yaakov. Yaakov was the one who completed the work of elevating the creation in a microcosm, and then later the Jewish people, his descendants, are going to do it in the macro and are going to affect all of creation in its entirety. So let's, as we discussed, just briefly to review the difference between, in order to appreciate Yaakov, we need to briefly review the unique contribution and the difference and the strengths and the weakness of what of Avram's avoda, of what Avram accomplished, and the same as Yitzchak, his accomplishments and his shortcoming. Avram, the manner in which he reached out to the world was to teach and to inspire. Avram was shining light. His life was a life of illumination. Wherever he went, he was showering his environment with godly consciousness. He engaged people in conversation. He taught them. He inspired them. He brought them to an awareness. The shortcoming in Avram's work was that he reached to everybody. He didn't make any conditions. He didn't make any stipulations. Didn't demand any refinement from his students, from those who are going to receive his light. And for that reason, his imprint or his effect that he had was temporary. The people in which he inspired experienced great godly awareness, but they never became a vessel to retain it. They never integrated it. They never took it in. It didn't become them. It was a light that was shining in them. It's like taking a light, shining into a dark pit. So the light is there. The light is present. And while you're in the pit and the light is shining, there is light. But the moment you shut the flashlight or this beam of this light, it's dark again, because the place itself did not become luminous. The pit did not absorb the light. The world did not absorb Avram's light. That's why we learned in last week's class that Avram's students and his followers followed him as long as they were with him. They were drawn to his charisma and to his great kindness and the exuberance and his light that he was shining. But we don't find that from all the Kerem, Avram made thousands of converts, as Maimonides says. He went from place to place. All those converts, where are they? They all disappeared. We would think that the Jewish people should be built on those that are descendants from Avram and those that Avram converted. Because the converts that he converted wasn't a true conversion. He didn't change them in a permanent way that they will become a people that are a godly people. He couldn't accomplish that. He inspired, but only for the short term. Yitzchak had a much deeper effect on the world, because Yitzchak's job was to make the recipient into a vessel to receive his light, to retain it. And the way he did that was by making demands of his students. That's why we don't find Yitzchak having such a broad influence, because he made many, many conditions. He required of his students, of his disciples, to work on themselves, to work, and the work meaning to refine their character traits, to refine their entire self, for them to be able to be eligible, for them to be, for godliness and holiness to stick, for it to become absorbed within them. And as discussed last week, this was indicated in Yitzchak digging wells. The meaning of a well is that you have to peel away in order to get to the water. And in our sense, the water is representing godliness and holiness. In order, because water is life, and Hashem is life. In order to get to water, it's requiring you to peel away, to take your earth stones, which in the human life, representing all the things that are obscuring and hiding God. Because in essence, every person has in his inner being a spark in which he or she can recognize and connect to God. It's only that it's blocked. It's blocked with layers of junk, and that can be all kinds of stuff. It's the ego, and then it's arrogance and pride and jealousy and excessive pursuit of materialism. All these things are covering and blocking of a human being's perception of godliness and his attachment and devotion to dedicate and devote his or herself to worshiping something beyond themselves, because the person is stuck up in themselves, stuck up in their ego. So Yitzchak said, I am not going to give you my water. I'm not going to, like Avram, pour water for everyone, water of godliness. I want of you to discover your own water. I want you to dig and dig. But in order to do that, it requires a lot of self-discipline. It requires a lot of rigorous work. So when Yitzchak's students, they were really kelim. They were really vessels for godly light. However, the shortcoming or the downside of Yitzchak's work was that he was limited in who he can reach, because he required total transformation. Not everybody was ready for that deep transformation. It was only those that were refined, had of a refined nature to begin with. Those were the ones that Yitzchak was able to inspire. That's why we find that when he dug his wells, he dug them in Eretz Yisrael, and he didn't dig his wells outside of the land of Israel. God didn't let him go outside of the land of Israel, because the type of the method and the holiness that Yitzchak brought was one that can only be developed. It can only be reached by people that have a somewhat elegant, an elegant nature to begin with, and therefore they're both attracted to that kind of difficult labor and that difficult work, and they're also willing, they have the energy and the ability to be able to refine themselves. People that are of a coarser nature. Yitzchak didn't deal with the lowly people that Avram did. Avram was involved and spoke to people that bowed down to the dust of their feet. As we spoke last week, what that means, how lowly these people were, and Avram dealt with them. Avram also went out of the land of Israel, went to a lowly, immoral place like Egypt, and was in Mesopotamia first, was outside, which means his light was shining everywhere. He had no limitations in where he could come. Yitzchak, however, was limited to stay within the land of Israel, which means he can dig a well in the earth, but only in holy, in earth that is not that, that is not that earthy, and that is not that thick, and is not blocking, doesn't have such a thick blockage to the water within it. He couldn't dig a well outside of Eretz Yisrael. So that was the shortcoming of Yitzchak. So we can say something like this. Avram reached all of the darkness, but he only reached it externally. Yitzchak affected deep. He reached internal and caused a transformation, but he only affected it. He was limited. He only reached the higher part of the world, the higher rungs of creation, and not the lower rungs of creation. As mentioned last week, because of this, the difference of Avram and Yitzchak, this also expressed itself in their toldos, in their children. Because they did not rectify the world completely, this was symbolized or expressed itself that their children themselves, they produced unholiness, because their work in transforming the unholy was incomplete. Not their fault, because they were beginning this work, and it's going to be a work that involves, it's a progressive kind of a work. It takes many, many stages. But because their work was incomplete, that's why they too, even in their own family, had children that were unholy and even wicked. And that was Esav and Yishmael. However, just like, as we said, meaning there was still a realm of darkness left over after Avram's avoda, after Avram's work, but in as much as there was darkness, but they did impact and influence the darkness, they had an influence also on their children, on Yishmael and on Esav. And the influence was different, because Avram's impact on Yishmael reflected Avram's work. Yitzchak's impact on Esav reflected and was characteristic of Yitzchak's work. Avram had a son. First of all, Yishmael came from a very dark place. He was a son of a maid, which means in order to produce Yishmael, Avram entered and engaged and got involved with darkness. And in, because that's Avram's power, that he has no limitation, he can go into a very dark place. He created
and as a result of him, a dark human being. What do we mean dark? Dark is not necessarily dark, meaning someone who, by his very nature, is in a state of detachment from God. Yishmael lived a life of rebelliousness and disconnection from Hashem. But the beauty of Avram is that he's able to illuminate Yishmael's heart and Yishmael's mind, even while Yishmael is dark. For that reason, Yishmael did tshuva at the end of his life. And as explained last week, that was a direct result of Avram's light that he was shining into Yishmael. That's the power of chesed. On the other hand, Yitzchak, but even after he did tshuva, it was only a temporary tshuva, because Yishmael's descendants went back to their sinfulness. Today, even till today, Yishmael is still a blockage and an interference with the implementation of the divine kingdom in the world. Yishmael is still making all the tzaris. Why? Because the tshuva was not a permanent tshuva, because it wasn't. It was an Avram manner. It was Avram's light. It was never, Yishmael never absorbed it. On the other hand, Yitzchak had a much deeper effect on Esav, seen by the fact that Esav is, first of all, Jewish, unlike Yishmael, which means that Esav, even the unholiness that Yitzchak is producing, Yitzchak is able to change that unholiness and make it holy. So that's why he made Esav, his essence, his root, is Kedusha. He's a Jew. And also, whatever he changed permanently. But he couldn't change the whole thing. That's why, indicative in the fact that Yitzchak was buried with Esav's head, or Esav's head was buried with Yitzchak. The upper part of Esav was elevated, not the lower, but he couldn't affect the body. The body remained in an unholy state. The head was transformed. That's why he took his head, which is indicating that he can only reach the tippy top of Esav, not the lower part of Esav. But the part that he does reach is thorough, is complete, remains buried with Yitzchak, which means it's attached to Kedusha forever and ever. In order, however, to do that, he must remove that head from the rest of the body, but the dark lower part of Esav he couldn't affect. Here is where we come to the last and final stage of the transformation of unholiness of the world, and that is to produce a person like Yaakov. Yaakov is the one who can complete the work, because Yaakov integrates both powers, both of the energies of Avram, of chesed and gevurah, of light, of chesed, which is kindness, and restraint. And as a result of that harmony, which is the harmony of teferes, which is beauty, which is the combination of chesed and gevurah, Yaakov is able to accomplish both things. First of all, he's able to reach even the farthest places. He has no limitation of how distant and how far he can go in terms of bringing godly awareness to that place, but hand by hand, he enables the recipients of that light to be elevated and absorb, that they themselves can absorb that light, even though they're very lowly, that they can be transformed and absorb it in a permanent manner. So he reaches everywhere. As the Torah says this week, Hashem blesses Yaakov, Ufaratzta yama v'ked matzafayna v'negba. You're gonna spread into all directions, all across the world, to the east, to the west, to the north, to the south, which means any kind of darkness, any kind of opposition, each direction represents another element of a blockage that can block and obscure godliness. Your light will penetrate. And the word paratzta means you will break, because Yaakov breaks all the boundaries. There is no limitation. There's no obstacle that can stand in his way. His power can reach the farthest, farthest places. But at the same time, his effect is not only short, it's not temporary, it's permanent, it's forever. He transforms the place that he comes to. Where do we see these two things? So first of all, we find that Yaakov, like his grandfather Avram in his life, travels. He travels and he goes outside of the land of Israel. And where does he go? He goes dafke into the darkest places of the world. First, he goes to Haran. Haran is called Haran because it angers God. Haroin. It's a place that is antithetical to Kedusha. That's why it's the people that live there were thieves, were liars. God is truth, and Klipa, the unholy, is deception. So it was a world of deception, a land of deception, a land of lies. Avram went to Haran, and then later on in his life, Avram went down to Mitzrayim like his grandfather Avram. And Mitzrayim is even a greater darkness. Mitzrayim was Ervas Ares, the most immoral place, a place steeped in paganism and idolatry and in all kinds of depraved elements. It was full of black magic and whatever kind of unholiness, of wickedness and darkness, the seat of all that klipa was Mitzrayim. And Avram and Yaakov is even stronger than Avram, is that Avram also visited Mitzrayim, but Avram was just a short visit in Mitzrayim. Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim and lived the last 17 years of his life. He established, brought his entire family there, and his descendants remained in Mitzrayim till, you know, for over 200 years, because that is the strength of Yaakov, to go down even into the darkest places and bring light, but more than just bring light, transform it. And that too we find different to Avram, that his influence was only short and only temporarily. Yaakov had a lasting transformational effect in the places where he went. That's the theme of this week's Parsha, Parshas Vayetze. Yaakov went out, and where does he go? You can see he went to Haran. What happened when he came to Haran? He came, as he says next week in the Parsha, I came myself. B'makli, meaning he is the Jew, in a sense, the naked Jew. He's coming without anything with him, his stick. There is the Jew himself. Yaakov comes to Haran, and over there he prospers. He prospers amazingly. As the Torah says, he gets married, has huge four wives, huge family, and then amasses this great fortune. Vayifreitza ish ma'oid ma'oid. The man became very, very wealthy. But if we look carefully, it's not just success that Yaakov had when he was in such a difficult environment, but what the Torah is emphasizing is how Yaakov transformed that negative environment. Because where did Yaakov produce his family? From what? Yaakov produced his family from love on himself. The very antithesis to holiness, Yaakov took the inner core, the inner root of Lavan, the soul of Lavan, he transformed it to Kedusha, to holiness. And that is seen. First of all, he married Lavan's daughters. But unlike Yitzhak also married the daughter of Besuel, which is of that unholy place, but there's a difference. Yitzhak influenced Rivka by first taking her out of the environment where she was in. He whisked her to Eretz Yisrael, and then she became his wife. Which means that he was only able to deal with the unholy when the unholy is in an elevated place. Rivka was brought up in Eretz Yisrael. She's not in the lowly, dark environment amongst her people. Then she can become the wife of Yitzchak and be attached and assimilated into Kedusha. Yaakov didn't do that. Yaakov, on the other hand, went down into Haran. And he was there for a long time, which means it wasn't he came and instantly. He had to work and change because he had to make a thorough transformation of the darkness. And he took the daughters that would have been the daughters of Lavan, the daughters, people that would belong in the realms of the unholy, and he made them the mothers of the Jewish people. But that wasn't just that. He then extended that to even the maids of Lavan. First the daughters of Lavan, and then the next stage, the maids of Lavan. And them too, he turned them into Kedusha. And you see later how Lavan recognized how Yaakov is robbing him from his family. He says to him, Habanois Benoisai, the daughters are my daughters, and Vabanim Banai, and the children are mine, and everything you see are mine. Because Lavan is realizing how Yaakov is taking away what is his and bringing it, because that was the whole idea of going to Haran, the sublimation, the transformation. And here you see again, let's contrast Yaakov with Avram. When Yaakov marries the maid, as we explained earlier, that means he's going into a dark place. The result and the consequences of that is that the child that is born is an unholy child, is Yishmael. It's only that into that unholiness, into that dark pit, Avram can shine his light and cause Yishmael to do tshuva. Yaakov, on the other hand, married the maids, which are, again, the representing the unholy, and he transforms the maids, unlike Yaakov, unlike Avram, where Hagar is still Hagar, and she's not considered, even if she does tshuva, but she's not considered a mother of the Jewish people. Yaakov takes the daughters of Lavan, and he makes them into the mothers of the Jewish people, and the children that are born from these maids are all shvatim. They're all shifteka. Because Yaakov, when he engages, when he confronts any obstacle to God, the manner, it's his effect on it, is to break the klipa entirely, break the unholiness entirely, and take its inner core and transform it to Kedusha. And then he continues further. After he finishes influence the human beings that are in the realm of Lavan, his influence extends to affect even the wealth, the cattle of Lavan, which means he's going even lower. Humans are by the very aspect of a human being is the highest part of the creation, the most receptive to holiness. The animals are in a lower state. And Yaakov's ability was to take the tzayin of Lavan. As we look in the parsha, there's such emphasis, not just that Yaakov made wealth, but he took Lavan's wealth. And later he hears the children of Lavan are saying that Yaakov took what belongs to our fathers. That's the theme of the parsha. Yaakov is taking Lavan's wealth, his tzayin, his things that he would use that money for all of his corruptness, and Yaakov is taking that wealth and turning it into Jewish wealth in order for it to be used for what's right, what's moral, what's ethical, what's decent in the world. And he completes his work with Lavan, and he's not done yet. He's not done yet. Yaakov now goes to the next stage. Again, as we mentioned earlier, when Lavan sees what Yaakov ran away, meaning he ran away with Haran. He took Haran with him. It's interesting. I don't know if there's any mention in the Torah anymore after this story about Haran. Because Haran is gone. Yaakov completely wiped Haran clean from any of its energy and its wealth. He took it all with him. And again, as Lavan, you see, is beside himself in complaining, what have you done? Again, your family is my family, your children are children. But Yaakov says goodbye and he leaves with it. But then he goes on to this next project. Because Yaakov's life is all about entering into the darkness and converting the very darkness to light. The next stage is, once he's done with Lavan, he's faced with even a lower klipa, with a force of darkness that is even lower than Lavan, and that is Esav. And as we mentioned earlier, Esav, Yitzchak also affected Esav. But Yitzchak's effect on Esav was only limited. He was only able to relate, or was only able to pick and raise the head of Esav. The rest of the body of Esau is dark. Yaakov's agenda or mission that God has given him is to completely rectify Esau. And we see it the moment he was born. The Torah says, why was he called Yaakov? Because, and a name expresses the true nature of who you are. He's called Yaakov because Yadoi Oichezes Ba'akev Esav, because his hand was holding on to the heel of Esav. When Yitzchak reaches Esav, he reaches only the tippy top of Esav, only the head of Esav. Yaakov is able to grab Esav, the entire Esav, and he reaches Esav even all the way down at the heel, the very bottom of Esav. That's where Yaakov takes a hold. And in the end of days, Yaakov is going to complete the job. But Yaakov was on the move. When he finished with Lavan, he moved to the next project was the sublimation of Esav. He sent messengers to Esav, but he thought that Esav is ready to be rectified, but Esav wasn't ready yet. The thorough transformation of Klipa and someone, especially an unholiness, an opposition to holiness like Esav, is going to take much, much, much detailed work. It's not going to go so quickly. So Yaakov sent the messengers to Esav thinking that he's ready to be elevated immediately. However, Esav was not ready. When he saw Esav is coming to fight him with the 400 men, Yaakov realized that noch nicht, meaning not yet. Esav needs some more time. So he affected him in this conference, in his meeting with Esav. He had an influence on Esav, but it was a very short influence, which means at the very time of the meeting, Esav, who wanted to kill him, suddenly was transformed, and he kissed him instead of killing him. However, so that kind of effect was like an Avram effect. He shined holy light on Esav. For a few moments, Esav felt like a brother to Yaakov, and he felt that he should be a supporter of holiness instead of fighting it. But then, it was only short-lived. Esav invites Yaakov to come with him to Har Seir, to the land of Esav. But Yaakov says to him, I will come. You go ahead, and I will come. And as Rashi says, Yaakov didn't go to Har Seir. It means when Mashiach will come, Va'olu Mashiach Bahar Tzion, those that were saved will go up on the mountain of Tzion, Lishpot Eshar Esav, to judge the mountain of Esav. And the judging of the mountain of Esav means that at the end of days, after 3,000 years of the application of Torah and Mitzvahs, and the Jews being scattered amongst the nations, together with our brother Esav, through our mingling and interactions that we have with Esav, we achieve a total transformation of Esav himself. And that's the meaning of lishpat. To judge doesn't mean to punish. To judge means to affect the deeper change on Esav, which means to elevate all of humanity and make them all vessels for godly light, as it's going to be when Mashiach comes. When Project Esav, of rectification of Esav, began by Yaakov, but not completed, Yaakov turns in the end of his life to confront the lowest of the low, and that was Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim was the darkest klipa, the darkest shell, the greatest, thickest husk that is blocking godliness was Mitzrayim. And so Avram went there to have a short influence on it. I guess he paved the way. Then Yaakov goes to Mitzrayim. But Yaakov, unlike Avram, settles in Mitzrayim. He lives there for 17 years. He brings his family there. His family is there for 210 years. The Jewish people, again, similar to Haran, are established, grow into a nation in the land of Mitzrayim. But what do they do in Mitzrayim? They transform Egypt. Because when they went out of Egypt, they took out the entire wealth of Mitzrayim, and Mitzrayim ceased to exist afterwards as a superpower in the world. Why? Because Mitzrayim was integrated into the Jewish people. The Jews took, as it says, Vayenatzlu etz Mitzrayim, they took all the wealth of Mitzrayim with them, and instead of it being used, the gold and the silver, to make idols and build temples to the gods of Egypt, all this gold was now utilized in building a Mishkan for Hashem. That is the mission of the Jewish people, and as established by Yaakov. The ability and the strength to reach every kind of obstacle, every kind of darkness, to break it and then transform it. And this is the reason why, now we'll understand why Yaakov was able to do dealt with Avimelech differently than Avram and Yitzchak. See, Avimelech is the force, the root of the unholy in this world. And that's why we find him the entire, at least by the first two avos, he keeps on resurfacing as someone that needs to be dealt with. They're dealing with him gently, but he's a troublemaker. And as we said earlier, you see from what the Philistines were doing, the Pelishtim. They're still a problem today, or at least what call themselves Pelishtim. Palestinians, Pelishtim, this is a force of anti-godliness, anti-holiness. As we see, they were stuffing the wells of Avram. What is the wells of Avram? What are the wells of Yitzchak? These are the wellsprings of godly light, the waters of light, the waters of holiness that are here, as it says, when Mashiach comes, the world will be filled with divine knowledge, kemayim leyam hachasim, like the water covering the sea. Those waters, where are they coming from? The waters that are going to cover the world, the entire world is going to be submerged in a sea of divine knowledge. That divine knowledge, that water, is coming from the springs that Avram and Yitzchak have dug. It's from those wells. They began the job of disseminating godliness around the world. Avimelech is stopping those wells. He's getting in the way. So that is indicative of who Avimelech is. He is the, we might say, Avi, the father, Melech, of the kingdom of unholiness, the root of unholiness. Now, Avram and Yitzchak, because they didn't thoroughly transform darkness to light, they weakened it, they infiltrated, but not completely. So they could not eradicate Avimelech. That's why, what did they do? What was the idea of this covenant they made with Avimelech? The covenant was a ceasefire. It was a non-aggression pact. I'm not going to hurt you, you're not going to hurt me. Let's be friends. Meaning to say, as long as I'm living my life and I'm doing my thing and you're doing your thing, we're okay. Meaning Avram and Yitzchak are not working on changing Avimelech, on eliminating Avimelech, on destroying it. They're just asking from Avimelech, or Avimelech is asking of them, let's leave each other alone. You do your thing, I do my thing. Now, had Avram and Yitzchak not done their work in laying the seeds for holiness in this world, Avimelech, as he did initially, would not be okay in letting them do their work. He would stop them, like he tried doing, like his servants tried doing, in blocking the wells that they dug. But as a result of the work of that Amram affected the world and that Yitzchak affected the world, Avimelech was weakened, at least to that he is neutralized. He cannot fight. He must put down his weapons and allow Amram to do his work. But Avimelech himself remains a force of evil, a force of unholiness in the world. That is what we mean when we say that because they made the covenant, they delayed the coming into the land with seven generations. It doesn't mean that their act actually caused, that it was a sin, and because they did it, it caused the delay of the Jewish people into the land of Israel. Rather, what it means is like this. The very same reason why Avram and Yitzchak made a treaty with Avimelech is the reason why it took seven generations for the Jews to enter in the land. Because to enter the land, conquering the land, means that the Jewish people take hold of the earth, planet earth, and make it into a home for God, make it into a Jewish land. To accomplish that, in order for it to be accomplished thoroughly, completely, in order for the transformation to be to its fullest, there cannot be any darkness left. Darkness and evil must be vanquished completely. In the generation of Avram and the generation of Yitzchak, this was the elementary stage of holiness reaching and affecting the world. It was still a preliminary stage of Kedusha, and they hadn't destroyed the evil yet. So for that reason, they couldn't conquer the land, because there was still an Avimelech in the world. There was still unholiness. So that's what the meaning is. It's going to take seven generations, which means it's going to take seven generations of Kedusha to seep into the world and to eliminate and eradicate slowly through the seven generations until it completely can destroy the unholy from the world. And then the Jews can take the land. So there was a condition. The world was in a state where it could not be completely elevated yet. They wasn't ready for it. It would take seven generations. For that very same reason, Avram had to make a ceasefire with Avimelech. The best we can do is restrict Avimelech and limit him in his war against holiness. So they did the right thing. And their making of the covenant is not what's causing the conquest, but that's a symbol. From this that we see that Avram and Yitzchak couldn't destroy Avimelech. Instead, they had to compromise with Avimelech and make a treaty with him, make a peace treaty with him. That itself, or like pacify Avimelech, that itself is a symbol and indicative of the condition of the world, that the world has not been transformed yet. And it would take some time until this would happen. The fact that Yitzchak, we would think that after Avram finished his work, Yitzchak is ready to eliminate Avimelech completely. From this that we see that Yitzchak has to renew the treaty is a sign that even after Avram's work and even after Yitzchak's contribution, Yitzchak still didn't affect the world to eliminate evil completely and darkness completely. It would still take seven generations. Yaakov, however, he's the man of transformation. He is the man who says, okay, if the work now has to be, which my fathers had had begun of starting the process of weakening the unholy, well, let me go ahead and finish that job. So he began the seven generations of transformation. And that's why Yaakov doesn't want to deal, and he's not allowed to make a treaty, because his job is not to pacify the unholiness, to make treaties with the unholiness, to make a ceasefire with the unholiness. His job is the complete transformation of the unholiness. So therefore, what does he do? Because there is an Avimelech, Vayelech Harana, he goes to Haran. He goes on a mission to Haran to transform the darkness. Not to compromise, to change it. And he has to, in order to change it, he must enter into the belly of the beast. He must enter into the kishkes of the unholy. Where does he go? He goes to the fortresses of darkness. He goes to Haran, and then later he goes to Mitzrayim. Vayelech Harana, he goes down to Haran to bring about a transformation. Now it's interesting. We said that Haran was a dark place because it's Haroin Af. It's a place that, its very definition is a place that gets God angry, which means that the life in Haran was antithetical to morality and to holiness and to a godly way of life. But it's actually in the very bricks and stones. It's in the very cement. It's in the very land itself that Haran represents that which is ungodly, and that is. Hinted to us again in the word Haran. If we look at the word deeper, it says that the word Haran, if you rearrange the letters, spells the word Nichar. And from Tehillim, where it says, Nichar groini, I am a horse. My throat is horse. What does it mean, a hoarseness? When Hashem created the world, Hashem invested of himself into the creation. And that is why the nature of every creation should really be that the creation senses the fact that God is creating it, because if God has not put his input, if Hashem has not invested divine energy into the creation couldn't possibly exist. So at the root, the nucleus of every creation is divinity, is godliness. So every creation should know God with an intrinsic knowledge. Why then are the creations so oblivious to the creative life force that's creating them? And that is because godliness is silenced in this world. That the godly light that Hashem has put in the world is not felt and sensed within the creation. Hashem made it that way that the creation should not connect and not feel the very energy that's giving them their existence. Now, the energy that's creating the world is connected to the speech of Hashem. How did Hashem create the world? He spoke. Ki hu amar vayehi. He spoke and the world came into existence. Basara mamorais nivra olam. With the 10 utterances, the world was created. But now, usually when someone speaks, you hear him. But when a person is hoarse, he speaks words and you don't hear those words. So when Hashem spoke and he created the world, Hashem's voice in the upper realms of the creation, in the higher worlds, the creations hear the echo, they hear God's voice speaking, and that's why they're devoted and dedicated to divine worship. They are completely immersed in serving their creator because they sense that the entire existence comes from the creator because they hear Hashem's speech. Down here below, however, there is a hoarseness. That's what Haran means. Nichar, Hashem's voice isn't heard. He's overshouted by all the egos that are over here, all the big shots that are blocking godliness, and his dasara mamaris are not felt and sensed within the creations. And that is, so that's Haran, and that's why it angers God. Why does it anger God? Because Hashem is not felt there. And why is he not felt there? Because he himself blocks himself from being felt there, which is speaking, but speaking in a whisper, speaking in a manner where he's not heard. Yaakov's avoda was to go to the place of that hoarseness, of that darkness, and to reveal the divine speech that is implicate in every creation. That is why the pasuk adds a hey to the word Haran. Vayelech, and where did he go? Haran hey. Haran, no. He went to Haran in order to reveal the divinity that's in it. Why? Because behei nivra olam hazeh. With the letter hey, God created this world. The hey is the root of speech. All speech, really, the reason why Hashem created the world with a hey, even though he created it with 10 utterances, because hey is breath, and all speech comes from breath. So from that initial breath that Hashem breathed into the creation, from that he spoke all the 10 utterances which creates the world. So the hey is the root of the Asara Mamaris, of the 10 utterances. So Yaakov goes down to Haran, to a place where the divine speech isn't felt and sensed, and he is there, Haran hey, to reveal the hey in that in, in in Haran. That's his objective. Okay. So we follow Yaakov, and we see, what does Yaakov do? Vayifga b'makom. He comes to the place. See, in the first few verses in this parasha, we see the entire objective and the role of the Jewish people in this world and the accomplishment of what Yaakov, and really all of us are descendants of Yaakov, of what our work is comprised of. Vayifka b'makom. The first thing the pasuk says is he bumps into makom, into the place. Simply, it means he came to Hara Meria and he davened over there. But on a deeper level, vayifka, as soon as you go out of the land of Israel, a land of godly light, and you're stepping out, and the mission is to elevate the darkness of the creation. The first element of darkness is time and space. Space itself is a concealment and a blockage on godliness. The fact that there is a makom, there is a place, and there is this place, and there is that place, and we don't see the intrinsic holiness that's within it. Vayifka, he bumps. You bump in. I mean, a holy soul comes into this world and he bumps. He's confronted with something called space. He's confronted with physical entities that seem to be unrelated to anything godly and anything holy. Vayifka b'makom. Why does he come? Why is vayifka b'makom? Vayalan sham kibba ha-shemesh. Why do you bump into makom, into this hard surface called physical matter? That is because kibba ha-shemesh, because the sun has set. The sun is representing divinity, godly light. As it says, Kishemesh umoga in Hashem Elokim. Hashem is compared to the sun, to the rays of the sun, or the light of the sun, or the sun itself, which gives off which is the source of heat, warmth, and energy, and so forth. Why is there a makom? Why is there because we said earlier, because Hashem is concealed and hidden, like the hoarseness of Haran. That's Kiva Hashemesh, because the Shemesh of Yudke Vavke, the Shemesh of godly revelation, that is shining maybe in Eretz Yisrael, that is shining in the heavens above, but down here below, Kiva Hashemesh, over here there's sunset, it's dark, there is a night. So what do you do? Vayolin Sham. We lodge over there, which means we are put in. Yaakov comes into a place of darkness, 20 years, where he's going to lodge in the darkness, as he stayed in Haran for 20 years. And what does he do over there? He begins his work. His job is vayikach, to take me'avnei hamakom, to take the stones of the makom, which means he is picking up the makom. However, when he's going to pick up the makom, which means he's picking up physical matter and elevating it, he can reach for the higher parts of the makom, which means he can reach to the human beings to elevate humans. He can reach to animals. He can reach to plants. Or he can reach all the way down and to the very physical, most physical element of the makom. And that is the greatness of Yaakov. Immediately, he doesn't work starting with the higher parts, because the chiddush of Yaakov, as we said earlier, is ufaratz da yam avakedma, no barriers. His light can reach the darkest, that which is the greatest opposition. So vayikach, he takes me'avnei, the stones, the elements that are the most physical, the most material, the most deceptive. The physical world is lying to us in its appearance, that it seems it doesn't have any life at all. That's why we live in such illusion and forget about Hashem, because we're constantly surrounding and seeing stuff that seems to have an independent existence, autonomous existence, without any life to it, especially inanimate objects, because they seem to be in existence without any energy, without anything, without any life to it. And that creates an illusion of a godless existence. So Yaakov confronts and he immediately tackles Avnei, the stones of the makom. And what does he have? He has many stones. Because that's what symbolizes our world, the world of fragmentation. When you don't, when the creations do not recognize their common denominator, and that is that they're creations of God, when they're not connected to their single root, which is Hashem, which is Echad, which is oneness, each one is living onto their own, then we have a fragmented world. Yaakov takes the many stones, Avnei, the many. And what does he do with them? Vayasem, and he puts them in Rashi Sov. He lifts it up to his head. What is the head of Yaakov? The head of Yaakov is the divine consciousness of Yaakov. By the way, Yaakov's job to reach, to bring divinity and godliness into the world is hinted to in the name Yaakov itself, because Yaakov is Yud Ekev. Yud, which is the pintala, the little core, the spark of divinity in the soul, because the Yid's neshama, the Jew's neshama, and we're called actually Yidden, because that's who the root of who we are is, we're a Yud, which means our essence is in divine, in the first letter of Hashem's name, the Yud, which is the point of absolute integration into the infinite light, the spark, the pintle Yid, our essence. And that essence, that neshama, comes down Akev into a heel. The body is the heel, and this world is considered the heel. The heel is a place where there is lacking life. Our neshama, Yud Akev, Yaakov Avinu's power is that he has to take the Yud, which is the pure, intense, godly awareness that he has in the inner recesses of his soul, in the inner core of his being, and disseminate that into the Akev, into the heel. And that's what it means. He takes the stones and he connects them to his head, the Rosh Chayesav, which means the head of Yaakov is the Yud in Yaakov's name, which means he brings soul consciousness and he permeates and he penetrates the very stones, not just his own body, but in the environment that's around him, and even the lowest parts of the environment, he connects them to that one singular Yud, which means he utilizes all the physical objects that he comes in connection with. And even though they're suggesting that they should be used for matters that are other than serving God, Yaakov takes them all and assembles them all into oneness, into the service of Hashem. That is why, after he puts it under his head, what happens to the stones? All the stones become one stone. That's the achievement of our father Yaakov. To take the many, to take all the fragmented pieces of our life, all the disconnected elements, to join them all together. And what happens to the stone? Yaakov picks up the stone after he turned them into one stone, because it was, he connected it to his head. And then he says, all the way later, he says, Va'even hazos, and this stone, ashesamti matseva, that I have now placed as a, he establishes as a matseva, as an altar for God, or as a statue, pillar or whatever, for Hashem. And then he says that this stone is going to be base Elohim. It's going to be the home for Hashem. That's the purpose of us, to take the entire world and make every part of the world into a base Elohim, into a house for Hashem. And that's what Yaakov, so that was Yaakov's aspect. He picked up all the parts, and that's what he's going to be doing in Haran for 20 and so years. He's going to take each sheep, every little part, every aspect of the Haronian environment, and he's going to pick it up and elevate it and turn it into a base Elohim, into a house of Hashem. So that's the gist of how it happened to Yaakov. And I mentioned earlier, we are also descendants of Yaakov. And in a sense, this Yaakov's journey into Haran is really the journey of each and every one of us. Hashem sends our neshama too into this world. Our neshama is again, as mentioned earlier, Yud. That's where our neshama comes from. Our neshama is sent down into the Akev, into the heel. And we are dispatched into Haran. We are dispatched for us over here. We're put into Los Angeles. We're put into whichever place in the world. The street, the environment that we live in is not necessarily a holy place. It's not conducive to spirituality, to holiness. It doesn't make you search for God. Quite on the contrary, it makes us forget Hashem and get involved in other things. Our job is to be strong, to remain connected to Hashem, but much deeper than that, to take the very environment itself, transform it into a place receptive to holiness. That comes through the interactions that we have with people and through the utilization of all the physical things that we have, from our car to our computer, our pillow, our toothbrush, our pajamas, and our whatever garment we have, and every aspect that comes our way, we are to use them all to the service of Hashem. To pick up the Avnei HaMakom, to pick up the stones of the place, and turn it into one stone so that it all can be a Beis Elohim. This is the descent of the neshama. Now, interesting, there's another meaning, it's very important, to Be'er Shava. We said earlier, it means where Yaakov made the oath, but it also says that Be'er Shava is the source of where the neshama comes from. The neshama comes from the attribute of Malchus, which is the source, the final source of the neshama, and that's called Be'er Shava, because it's the well that is holding all the seven sephiros, the seven godly emotions, which is a Kabbalistic idea which we're not going to get into right now. But another point is that before a neshama comes into this world, the neshama is given a very, very intense infusion of godly light in order for able to be strong to withstand the trials and tribulations that it's going to confront down here below in this world. And that's what it says, that before a neshama is born, mashbi anoisai, they place an oath on the neshama, tehi tzaddik, be a tzaddik, v'alti rasha, don't be a wicked person. It says that the word shavua, besides it, an oath, also comes from the word sova, which means sova means full. They fill the neshama until the neshama is completely satiated with intense godliness, so that the neshama should have the power to be able to withstand the difficulties of dealing with a dark world, and not being affected by it, but transforming it and elevating it. And that's the meaning, Vayetze Yaakov, the neshama descends, from where? Mebe'er Shava, from the oath that it took when it was up there, a shavua that is given to the neshama, which means the empowerment to come down and to change the world. Vayelech, and where does it go? Haran, down to Haran in order to change. Now here, I just want to conclude with one thing. We take a look at how Yaakov accomplished this. We see something very, very beautiful and very important. When Yaakov went to Haran, he left Be'er Shava, he didn't go immediately to Be'er Shava. The first thing he did was, he made a short rest stop. Took a little stop. Where did he go? He stopped in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'ever, and he spent 14 years. 14 years that Rashi says he didn't sleep, didn't stop for one moment. 14 years of continuous study. Now, his parents said he should go get married. Yaakov was running away from Esav. He needed to go to Haran. He needed to go transform the world. Why did he stop for 14 years? Well, similar to what we had just said before, in order for the person to be able to withstand the tests, the difficult concealments that there is in the world, the person needs a lot of strength. So Yaakov knew that the only way he will be able to be a strong in his Jewishness, in his holiness, in his morality, in his ethics, he needs an extra dosage of Kedusha. So the 63 years that he lived in his father's house, that was nice. But now we need an intense 14 years, an intense period of not having no connection to any kind of material, physical things, completely devoted to holiness and godliness, to fill himself up with the light that would be necessary in order for him to be able to carry him through the darkness. That's number one that Yaakov did. The second thing that we see that Yaakov did for protection was he put stones around his head. And besides what we said earlier, that the stones around his head meant to elevate the physical elements in this world, it had another meaning. And that is that a person can only elevate the world if he retains a certain distance, a certain detachment, which means we can elevate our physical, our business environment, our home, and all the physical elements in life if we remain aloof to a certain degree from it. We have to be involved, but aloof. Which means that our involvement with all these things should be external. We do these things, but we do them without heart. We do them without passion. Our passion and our inner involvement must always be reserved for holiness, for godly things. That is why Yaakov went and he put stones around his head, which means he knows his body he's going to allow to enter into Haran. His head he must keep pure. He must be protected from the wild beasts, meaning from the negative things that are there. He should never immerse his head. Which means a person, it says in the Pasuk, Igiya kapecha kiseichal, the work of your hands you should eat, not the toil of your head. That's why a person should reserve his inner powers only for spiritual matters, for prayer, for learning, and so forth. So that's a second element. First element is before you enter, you need intense preparation. Secondly, even when you're there, you need to have a protection. And a protection on your head, and then you can continue onward. And then thirdly, it says, what was Yaakov doing when he was in Lavan's house? He said Tehillim. And he composed the 15 Shir Hamalos Yaakov composed when he was in the house of Lavan. Which means that even while you're doing your work, you have to know that we don't have the power. It's not our strength. It's Hashem's strength that we are conveying. And that's what Yaakov said in the 13 Shir Hamalos, in the 15 Shir Hamalos. He said, where is my help going to come from? This is too difficult. The darkness is too hard. May I, and from where does my help come? I don't have the strength. I don't know how I'm going to deal with this darkness. Ezri mayim Hashem osei shemayim ve'aretz. For me to reveal osei, the one who made heaven and earth, Ezri, my assistance, mayim Hashem, comes from God. From recognition and not taking the credit for himself, but recognizing this is Hashem's powers, then Yaakov has the strength to accomplish it. So these are the three things. Intense preparation, protection of your head while you're involved, and then prayer to Hashem while you're doing it, that Hashem should give you hatzlacha, Hashem should give you success in your work. With these together, we can be assured that the world will not overpower us and drag us in and contaminate our souls, but quite on the contrary, we will have a lasting, permanent effect on the creation, transforming it and elevating it. So this is really, which is a very important lesson for us. We see in our lives, we have a period when a person is born, we don't, Hashem made it that way, that we don't immediately engage the darkness of the world. Initially, for the first 20, 25 years of our life, a Yid, a Jewish boy and girl, is supposed to spend in the realms of complete Kedusha, of holiness, in yeshiva, in seminary, in schools, where they're learning and absorbing holiness. You do not go out to establish a family and to work until you really, really filled yourself with a lot of Kedusha. If you don't have that, then we would be completely run over by the unholiness and the darkness. Similar to Yaakov, that he went for 14 years to Shem Ve'Ever. And then after that, we can venture out. And then another element is, every day it's also the same thing. We cannot go out into our businesses, into the interaction that we have with the charon elements of the world until we first have a solid, strong morning, which is dedicated completely to Kedusha. And that is prayer, Torah study, strong prayer, strong study for an hour or two, or 2 or 3 hours in the morning. We first pray, then we're supposed to have a shir. We're supposed to deeply etch or connect ourselves into Kedusha, so then later when we go out, we can transform it. That's the second thing. Thirdly, as mentioned earlier, we have to make sure that our head is protected. And one very, very important thing, and that is just like Yaakov, just like the neshama is given an oath, before the neshama comes into the world, the neshama is given an oath, which empowers the soul, even prior to its descent, for it to be able to have all the spiritual nutrients and vitamins it needs, to be able to have the strength to withstand the temptations and to overpower the darkness. We too, every single day, need to go and go back to that oath. You know, when we do that, interesting, that is, we have to go back to Be'er Shava, to the oath. That is the night before, when we go to sleep, we say the special Kriya Shema, Alamita, on the bed, before we sleep. That, the last words of the Shema are, Biyadcha Afkid Ruchi, in your hands I give over my soul. Which means I am planting my soul and I'm giving it to you, Hashem. I want you to recharge my batteries. The words Biyadcha Afkid Ruchi are the acronym, the first letters are Be'er, which means a well. We are dipping our souls in, we're giving it to Hashem, for Hashem to immerse our souls in the spring of holiness, in godly, even while we're asleep, we're not even aware of it. But if we read the Shema properly before we go to sleep, very important that we do this. It's a small investment of our time, but if we say the Shema carefully with Kavana, saying every word, we're giving Hashem our neshama, and Hashem is going to fill our soul with godly light. He's going to keep our neshama dipped in godliness for an entire night, and that's going to rejuvenate our neshama, empower our soul. We wake up in the morning, we're a different human being. We have it within us. We have all the light. But, as again, we wake up with that renewed strength, then we have to take that strength out of our neshama and bring it into our consciousness to a solid 2-3 hours of morning devotion and dedication to spiritual pursuits and only to spiritual pursuits, similar to Yaakov in Shem Ve'Ever. And only after that, Vayela Charana, we have to go to Charan, and we have to go with simcha, with joy, like we find Yaakov later, Vayises Raglov, he lifted his feet with joy, knowing that he will have success and he will accomplish what he needs to accomplish in the ultimate transformation of darkness to light. May Hashem help. We should complete our job and see the coming of Mashiach. Take a miyad. Yeshua is here.